Hey, folks, before we start this week's episode, we want to tell you about this special event happening Friday, March 27th at the Hard Rock Cafe here in Seattle as part of the festivities surrounding the Emerald City Comic-Con, Crackle Fest 5, featuring openers Cy Fried and Meg Ran and Seattle area burlesque, not to mention the band Kirby Crackle. Yeah, it's going to be great, man. Did I say burlesque? Yes, I did. It's going to be there, and it was fantastic last year. It's going to be even better this year, and it's hosted by me, Aaron of the Air Raid Podcast. So get your tickets now. They're $10 in advance. You can go to KirbyCracklemusic.com, click on the show poster, and it'll take you directly there, or visit our show blog for this here episode and click the link and get your tickets now. Let's do this, man. Let's do it. Let's have a great time together. Okay, let's start the show. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 238, in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Yes, indeed, folks. We've got a great show planned for you this week. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. The one, the only, Mike McCready of the band Pearl Jam will be joining us here shortly. I had the opportunity to go down to the Tractor Tavern and sit outside, out back, with Mike and have a fantastic conversation about his life, how he got started playing guitar. What went along with the fame and the fortune of being in a band like Pearl Jam, and the trials and tribulations associated with that, and also his battle with Crohn's disease, and you know, things of that nature. So I think you're really going to enjoy this. Plus, Mike's got this new thing that he's doing called Hockey Talker Records, which actually was going on last week when we went and sat down for the chat. He's launching Hockey Talker Records, which is, you know, going to be putting out small runs of vinyl for a bunch of really great bands like Stereo Embers, the Pink Slips. Oh, man, Star Anna. I mean, it's great. It's great. And this is the one thing that I really admire about Mike, and we get into this a little bit in the conversation, is that he has really stuck to his roots, man. Here in Seattle, he was, you know, raised here in the city, and he's still playing with his friends. He's playing with his friends, playing music with his friends, which I find just awesome. And he's always playing these smaller clubs and everything like that, you know. And then he goes off with Pearl Jam, tours with Pearl Jam around the world, and plays stadiums to like 50,000 people. Right? I mean, that's a really admirable trait, in my mind, anyway. Yeah, it's really cool. So check out Hockey Talker Records as well, as Pearl Jam will be featuring music from the band Pearl Jam here throughout the episode. Yeah, I hope you guys really enjoy it. Hey, one other thing before we get into it here. I had an idea the other day, pertaining to listener John, who sent us in this voicemail with a new intro that he had made for the show, which, you know what, John, I'm really sorry we're not going to use it. It gave me this idea, like, hey, I need to put something else at the end of this show, right? Something special. So I was like, hey, what about an inspirational quote at the end of each episode to really just, like, you know, drive it home, right? Drive it home. Make everybody feel good for the rest of the week, right? So that's what we're going to do. It's something special. There might be a little surprise associated with it. We're going to start doing that at the end of each episode of the Air Raid Podcast, okay? Yeah, all right. Sounds good. Okay, let's get into it, shall we? Okay, let's go with our first musical break. This song is called Given to Fly off of the album Yield, which came out in 1998 by the band Pearl Jam. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Mike McCready. All right, everybody. Be back in a moment.
Alone in a corridor waiting locked out. He got up out of there, ran for hundreds of miles. He made it to the ocean, had a smoke in a tree. The wind rose up, set him down on his knee.
Prior to that, I was probably just into, kid stuff, soccer, skiing.
Cub Scouts,
definitely,
yeah.
Cub Scouts.
Yeah.
I was working on, with Danny Newcomb, actually. We were both in the same, a pack of Scouts, I guess. We were both working on our merit badges at the time. And he actually got a guitar first, and he lived on the block. And I was like, I want one too. Because I've known him since we were five
sure.
years old.
Yeah.
So he got a Mateo SG, and I remember that, and I remember being a little bit jealous and like, I want a guitar too. And my parents, said, you can have a guitar if you
get this merit badge.
Not that. I had to explain to my dad. I said, I'm kind of not into the Cub Scouts anymore. I want to do this because I discovered this band called Kiss, and I like, this is what I want to do, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They said, if you take lessons and keep your grades up in school, you can have a guitar.
That's a good set of parents right there.
They were very liberal and both working at the time. So, I was happy that they are, into that.
Yeah.
I didn't
yeah.
keep my grades up. But
no?
No, I just started practicing and playing music all the time. As soon as I got it, I got obsessed. We would practice, I don't know if you know all this, but Danny and I and Rick, and we would, when we were Warrior back in 1979, 78, when we started playing shows, we would practice all the time. Then when we turned into this band Shadow, we would practice literally 5 days a week for maybe 4 or 5 years. We would practice all the time. So,
and that was the focus?
That was the focus of everything.
So it was always just like, make this happen.
I don't know. Just like wanting it. It was a dream. It's like, let's, it's fun, you know, and you know, we're kids and, you know, girls seem to like it. So it's like, this is cool. And we love music and we get to play it and travel around in a little car and go to Bellevue or go out to Bremerton and play shows and, or play at our high school or play at our junior high or, you know, all that.
Yeah.
Played a birthday party. That's what we did our first Warrior Dare, the first show at Jenny Weintraub's birthday party. I think she'll be here tonight. But
really?
Yeah. 1978, I believe. Yeah.
That's great. Kinda That's rad. Great. How did it go? How was the first show?
I remember it being a little nervous. We got paid $100, I think, so that we put it back into the band. We got to buy a PA or put that money down on a PA. And that's when Chris was seriously 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah.
And I was 11, so Chris for real. And the show went well. We did One Way or Another by Blondie. We did the Beatles song that Cheap Trick did. What is it?
Come on. Day Tripper.
Day Tripper, thank you.
Yeah.
We did Day Tripper with Chris singing with a very high voice.
Nice.
We did a song called Raw, which is our own, and then the Wah song. We had a couple of originals. And
yeah, yeah.
That's all I remember.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But I remember it being pretty kind of rad, so.
Yeah. Were you nervous at all?
A little bit nervous. I have to jump back into my... I'm sure I was, but also I was a ham, so I loved it. You know? And then after that, I was hooked.
The rest is history.
I guess.
So
yeah.
They say.
Yeah.
So you guys morphed into this band called Shadow, mm-hmm. right? And you moved down to L.A.
Yeah.
What happens in L.A. with Shadow?
Wow. Well, I mean, we're all starving, and you know, we're all paying to play down there, and our first experience was saving up a bunch of money. I remember working at Kid Valley up here, and Chris worked somewhere, and Rick worked at the Dilettante or something. We all saved our money up so we could play our first show at the fabulous Whiskey. And little do we know that we had to buy our own tickets and sell them on the street.
Yeah.
But we couldn't do that because we were in Seattle, and nobody knew who we were. And it cost us like $600 to play. They made us pay to play.
Oh, my God.
Which is just awful, and I think they still do that, which shame on them for doing that. And so that was our first experience. We went down, and we played in December, I think, on a Sunday. Tim DiGiulio was there. And a couple of our other friends, and then Duff McKagan had moved down earlier than that.
Right.
And so we would follow it kind of just a backstory to jump back in the story a little bit. Duff had come to Rick's house about a year before, and he had this SG guitar strapped around him, and he was with our friend Karen Kolepnik, and we were just all hanging out. It's right after practice, and we're like, this was in '84. Like, what are you doing, man? What's going on? You know, and he was kind of the big deal around Seattle back then. He was the punk rock kid.
Right. Right.
That we all looked up to, and he's like, I'm going to LA to become a rock star or something like that and tomorrow, and literally had his car packed and had his guitar around him for some reason. We're like, all right, cool, whatever, man. We were kind of blown away by that and then forgot about it, and then cut to a year later, it's like he's, you know, you're starting to see the first EP they put out and like all these rumors of this band called Guns N' Roses that were starting to happen down there, and he was part of it. So we moved down after that. And thought that was kind of a good idea because we felt like it was kind of falling apart for us because we lost our singer and we lost Danny, who's playing headlining tonight. So it was just the three of us, me and Rick and Chris. So we went down there, you know, nobly trying to make our way down there. And, you know, we ended up paying to play. We played some pretty fun shows. Nobody really came. Sometimes they did.
How long were you down?
For a year. Yeah, about a year from mid-'86 to mid-'87. And I got sick with Crohn's disease down there. My first bout with it when I was 21. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So super painful and bloody and just a big nightmare.
Did you have any idea what was going on?
I didn't for the first couple of weeks until I went to the doctor. And then it was I thought it was like a food thing or something. And
yeah.
So he said, you have this thing called ulcerative colitis, which is the same as Crohn's. There's similarities and differences, but at any rate, at that time it was ulcerative colitis, and it just sucked. And so I decided that I need to move back to Seattle, and this isn't working, you know, because I was getting sick. And I think, you know, I think Rick wanted to stay down there, and Chris might want to stay down there, but I couldn't do it anymore. I was sick, and we were paying our dues, but I just didn't feel like... A, I was kind of not feeling good, and B, I didn't know where this was going to go. So I felt like I was going to go, I'll just go back to college and try to figure out later.
Yeah, yeah. And so is that what you did?
I did, yeah.
Went to school?
I went back to Shoreline Community College, which I dropped out of, because it was a two-year school I dropped out of. I was working at Picora's and at Julia's at the time, and living at home because I was trying to save up money again, and kind of dejected being a 20, 21-year-old, 22-year-old at that time, kind of like, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I'm over music. I can't do it anymore.
You were, that was it. That was it for
it's
music.
It's kind of done,
you were,
yeah.
You were not having it anymore.
I mean, I loved it, and I wanted it really badly, but I just felt like it wasn't going to happen, and I didn't want to, I don't know what, it, I feel like I needed to get away from it, and it was just a weird time, so.
Yeah. Well, how long after that, when you're moving back up here, you're doing school.
Yeah.
That you run into Stone Gossard and things start clicking.
I'd say probably 2 years after that.
Okay.
We all knew Stone from, I was in, back in, 82. He was the funny, sarcastic guy that would come around. And
sure.
So we liked him because we all had that sense of humor too, but he really had it. And he hadn't started playing music yet, but I knew him. And then we would go to parties back then that were super small with like metal guys and punk guys and girls and metal. It was a mix, and because it was so small here, the scene was so kind of, there wasn't a lot of people here. It was
right,
a small
right.
town.
Yeah.
So at any rate, we would all see each other at different parties. One party that I happened to go to one night, this is before Andy OD'd, I think. It was Tim DiGiulio was having it at his house or his apartment with Larry Steiner up on Broadway. And I remember sitting in there playing guitar, playing a Strat to a Stevie Ray Vaughan song. Like I was trying to figure out, couldn't stand the weather.
Okay.
And it was on the vinyl, and I was just sitting drinking a beer and playing in the other room at this party. It wasn't a big party, but then Stone came in and he's like, "Oh man, that sounds great," and blah blah blah. And, "Oh thanks, man." And we talked about Pete Droege a little bit because Pete Droege was our dear friend that was awesome and blah blah blah. Didn't hear anything from him. And then Andy Wood ODs. He dies, and I'm the timeline of this is all kind of blurry. But after he died, I got a call looking for me at Julia's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris told me that because Chris Friel worked there at that time.
Yeah.
Too. And he said, Stone's looking for you. And I was like, okay, what? What does he want? I don't know. So I called him up, and we just started playing. This is around probably late 89, early 90. And we just started playing, working on songs. He had a bunch of new riffs and new ideas.
But at this time, were you still just like, I don't want to get anything started?
No, I was cautious, but I was also optimistic because I felt, okay, Stone's the only guy I know that has a record deal, really legitimately has a record deal.
Right.
And I like him anyways, and he's funny, and we get along, and he's a great songwriter, so it's like, I felt like this is my chance. This is something that when I wasn't looking for it, it dropped in my lap.
Yeah.
So, and I was still like, I remember talking to him and going, man, I want to finish my degree. I'm trying to get in the University of Washington. I'm really nervous, but I'll jam with you. And then it just started feeling kind of fun and right. And it was just me and him. And he was working on the Alive riff and Even Flow, and Even Flow came a little bit later, but it was Alive, and a song called Dollar Short that turned into a song called Footsteps. Just stuff that he had laying around, and then we started messing around once, and a lot of stuff that's on the first record.
Yeah,
and so that kind of happened, and then we were like, he was keeping his hands or cards really close to his chest, and I was like, Do you want to start a band? What's going on here? I don't know, what's going on. And he said yes, and right
then. It's like you guys were girlfriend, boyfriend.
Should we start
this relationship?
Yeah, it was kind of that. I wanted to know what he wanted to do because I didn't know what it was fun, but there wasn't any kind of, Stone's kind of that way. He just keeps it real to himself.
Yeah.
So at any rate, he said yes, and I was like, okay, I'm, I thought about it for a little long, and I dropped out of school again. I was like, I got to try this. I've got to follow this.
Sure.
See where it goes.
Sure.
And Jeff wasn't around there yet. He was deciding what to do. He was with War Babies at the time. He had been sitting with them, or our friend Brett Sinsel and Tom McMullen. And I was like, not to get too much into this. This has already been out there, but it's just.
Oh, sure.
We were driving out to get our guitars worked on, Stone and I. And I said, we got to get Jeff Ament in the band. And he's like, fuck Jeff Ament. And I was like, no, we have to get Jeff in the band because you guys together are amazing.
Yeah.
You've done Green River. You've done Love Bone. He does artwork. He's a great bass player. You guys are the fucking rock stars together in Seattle. You know, yeah. Soundgarden was too. But he wasn't feeling that at the time, but I kept on him. And, and they had some dinner, and it was all cool after that. So then there's the three of us.
Things patched up.
They patched up, But, you know, who knows? We didn't have any... He was still signed, I think, along with Jeff. We're still signed to Polygram with the Love Bone deal. So they were trying to figure out how to get out of that. And there's a lot of that stuff going on, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's
me.
So, like...
The new guy.
Kind of the new guy, but I was around... I mean, I'd known those guys forever.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time Jeff saw me play was at... With Shadow at the Headbangers Ball. And he walked in, and I'm doing a solo, like a metal tapping solo, at the Moore Theater in 1983.
Uh-huh.
So that was the first... And then I, you know, we know Stone. We knew him from those parties that I was getting back to you about. But anyway,
yeah, sure.
That's
so. Was there any like? I mean, it sounded like you were a little bit fearful to kind of get back into this whole music thing. It sounded like it. You know, you probably come from a family who like puts a lot of
college education. Mom and dad. You know, dad worked for the Science Center and was a
Sound
Council of Governments and all sorts of that kind of stuff. And my mom was an art teacher for 29 years at the Villa. So there's a thing about getting an education, and there was, but they were still cool. You know, they had their own things and their issues and whatever, but they were still receptive to these kind of things. But yeah, I felt like, again, that this was I got to do this. You know, this is
a calling.
It was a calling, but it was also an opportunity. It was like, oh, this is a door that's open. If I don't walk through this now, it's never going to open up again.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's not going to do anything. We'll break up in a year. But I got to try at least try it one more time.
Yeah.
Plus, I was bummed. I really wanted to play music.
You know? That's great, man. Well, yeah. and Pearl Jam was born.
Yeah.
Right?
Right around, yeah. A lot of other stuff that happened. And it all had to happen in a certain order. And anyways.
Yeah. But that in You know, things start getting crazy for you guys. Things were getting crazy for a lot of bands here in Seattle. How did you cope with that? Because you're still a kid.
Yeah.
At this point,
well, I was 24, 25. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty young. You know, I was the cliche, I went out and partied guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's how I coped with it. For the first record, for the Pearl Jam record, we went out for a year straight. I remember that. And that was literally a year straight. We didn't come back. We might have come back once for Christmas. But
yeah,
we went hard. We went from Vans and opening up for Alice in Chains to more Vans to, oh, all of a sudden we have a bus. And then we're on this Chili Peppers tour because Soundgarden turned it down. And they went with Guns N' Roses. So we're going to go. But we got offered this Chili Peppers tour with the Pumpkins.
Uh-huh.
And so we opened up for that and the Blood Sugar Sex Magik. And we get a bus around that time.
Yeah.
But we're still paying for it. And, you know, the label's paying for it.
Right.
We owe
right.
all that money. We don't start really exploding until 1992 Lollapalooza, when the Peppers invited us on that, and we're the second band on the bill. And then that's when everything went fucking crazy.
Yeah,
so
that's when thousands of people are seeing
we're
you.
We're rushing the stage and sure. like 4:30 in the afternoon, you know, when it's Lush, then us, then Jesus and Mary Chain. And then
yeah.
it was such a wild, crazy tour. So I partied, you know, I was drinking and, you know, doing yeah. whatever. And much to my, I mean, if you look at early pictures, I'm in a fucking mess, you know. But that's kind
of. I did notice some. There were some where there was a quite bloated Mike McCready.
Some of the bloat ones that you see are, that's more prednisone from Crohn's.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Which is an interesting one. Which sucks
yeah.
to, yeah. It's a, yep. So you're, when I was really partying, I was super like 90 pounds. I mean, I'm not big anyways, but I was way, you'll see those photos. So,
yeah.
You know, that's, I think that's how, and we just kept. I felt like we were a great band, and let's just keep going, you know? And I wanted to blow the Smashing Pumpkins off the stage. I wanted us to keep fucking going, and Eddie had this thing about him. And really, for me, it was the first time that everybody was playing on all cylinders, and it was the power behind it. And
sure.
I felt we were good, and I wanted to get better. So there was that. There was an ambition in
yeah.
there.
Was
and
there competition in you for that kind of stuff? Were you looking
sure.
at it kind of competitively with other bands that were doing the same thing?
I would say, you know, yeah, there was. It wasn't overt and like in your oh, in your face,
yeah,
blow
yeah,
you away
yeah.
kind of thing. But it was just more, we're gonna bring it, and we're gonna bring it as hard as we can, like the Who did back in the day, or like whatever our heroes did.
Sure.
And hopefully that's gonna, you know, work. And
yeah.
and I think everybody was of that same mindset. I mean, we're all kind of crazy back then because we were young, and then we're all of a sudden we're selling millions of records. So it's like, what the fuck is this? You know, what is this? That how did we just go platinum? How did we just go double platinum? It's six times platinum? What? It doesn't make sense, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And you're still a band and you're playing, but you're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So you try to keep up, or you keep trying to keep up with that, or are you worrying about the next record, which is probably what I was doing at that time too.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, well, and like you said, this whole time you're dealing with Crohn's.
Yeah, that was a drag. Yeah. So,
I mean, and you kind of kept that a secret from
yeah.
your bandmates for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, I think they knew it because I was ashamed of it. It's like
yeah.
I shit myself, you know, with blood. It hurts. And it's like I was totally embarrassed and ashamed of it. And, you know, I'm a rock star and I don't want anybody to know that. And, you know, and it's a dirty secret and it's a reason I can keep partying because I'm in so much pain and blah, blah, blah. But,
yeah.
I mean, it's this thing. I think out of the pain that I've gotten from that, I turned into a better guitar player. I know that. I know that that has helped me channel some of that pain. So
because of just being able
just
to,
from, like
focus you, through it?
No, just being doubled over in pain, going, ah, and then
yeah,
getting
yeah.
through it, and then trying to have some sort of answers with it in terms of
sure.
music.
Yeah,
I'm sure that those two are correlated. Along with that is shame and not wanting to say anything and being quiet about it and shitting yourself on the bus and just a million times, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was.
Did it ever hit you on stage?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah,
a bunch. Last time it hit me was on. It was in front of like 55,000 people in New Zealand.
Oh my god!
6 years ago.
Yeah.
So it was a nightmare.
Oh my god!
So
what do you do? What do you do? You just play
just
through it.
I shit mean, myself and I go clean up and I come back.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you just. I mean,
so,
you just.
There's
used
nothing
to it
I can do. I have
well,
to.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Or I run off stage and I shit. You know.
Okay.
Like if I can.
Yeah,
but I didn't have any chance.
Yeah.
I was in the middle of a song on this one. So,
yeah.
But Luckily, I've been in pretty good remission for the last 6 years since that episode, so that hasn't happened. I'm not gonna, you know, I shouldn't have eaten fucking what we just ate, but no offense.
Taco Bell?
No.
Yeah.
So I don't know where we're going with all that, but that was a hard thing, but it was also, my dreams are coming true at the same time.
Right.
Like, I'm
right.
finally be able to be in a band and make money at it and just be in a good band, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And, like,
sure.
make money at it. What? I was just paying to play a few years ago at the Whiskey because it's a famous club.
Yeah.
And there was fucking 8 people there. So it's like,
right.
there was a juxtaposition. It was wild. I don't know how to put it into words.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it sounds like it was total whirlwind.
Yeah.
I mean, and being like, you know, I remember how I was in my mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I thought I had everything fucking figured out.
Sure.
You know? And I can only imagine what it would have been like if you know, you're playing in front of 50,000 people or something like that, you know, in a...
It was a huge rush, too. It was also exciting. You know, you're also like, this is fucking great. I love it. And I also felt like we hit pretty hard pretty quick. We didn't do a lot of time in the van. We paid our dues in our own ways. I know Green River went around the country a little bit, but I moved to L.A., and I feel like we did pay our dues, but it kind of came within a year, you know, or a year and a half. And then we're like, oh, God, we got to do another record.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's that whole thing. Is your next record going to be good? The record labels are all like, if you don't have a good second record, you're gone, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the second album curse that we all kind of... But I felt like we had enough songwriters in the band at the time, and I felt confident. Like, Daughter and things like that were starting to be played on the tour bus in the first tour, so...
Uh-huh. So not a lot of stress there with...
There was stress. Yeah. No, I can't say there wasn't stress. There was,
okay.
There was like, you guys... I remember doing Versus, the second record, and we were in at a place called The Site down in Northern California, and getting halfway through it, and then Ed had to stop because he didn't have the lyrics for the remainder of the songs, and I thought we were going to lose momentum, and, you know, there's all these things you think are going to happen.
Sure.
And the label's like, you guys are going to fucking disappear if you don't do a video, you know.
Right.
What do you mean you're not doing a video? You guys have to do videos, or you're gone. They were saying that to us every day. And we're like, we're not doing any more videos. We don't need to do them. We feel like they're weird. You're playing, but you're not really playing, and you're lip syncing,
right.
And it, you know. So when, and we don't need to be as big. And that was interesting logic to go with, though, because that was Jeff and Stone, and Ed's kind of theory on it. And I felt, well, maybe we should keep going with this thing, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't agree with him at the time, but I think had we not pulled back, we would have broken up for sure.
Really?
Easily, yeah.
That much.
Dude, this is so crazy, yeah.
Sure.
Within a couple records or something.
Right. Yeah. So dealing with that whirlwind, you did mention that, like, and dealing with Crohn's at the same time, you relied on drugs and drinking to kind of get you over the hump with some of that stuff.
Yeah, whatever was
now,
there.
Now, did it become such a problem that you had to, you know, do something about it?
Sure, yeah. I had to finally go... To take many attempts at trying to get clean, and it took a long time.
What were you doing? Was it just alcohol?
You name it. I was in it. Mostly alcohol and a lot of weed. So,
yeah.
But mostly alcohol.
Yeah.
But other stuff too. But
was there ever was there a bottom for you?
There was a series of bottoms. We'll put it that way. You know, and in blurry evenings, and just like almost getting kicked out of the band, and I'm sure a million times. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they stuck with me, and I went through rehab a couple of times, and you know, it took a while to get to where I'm at now. So let's put it that way.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
That's Danny Newcomb playing leads in there. I know that for sure. I've heard him do that since he was 10. Yeah, he used to.
Everybody has their licks that they go to, right?
Yeah.
Like every time I go to a guitar store, I've got this one lick that comes out on every single guitar that I'm testing out. Right.
Yeah.
Do you have a go-to?
I have licks. Yeah. When I go to a guitar store to check out guitars, I go, if I can start playing things that are just brand new and it feels like I'm getting something out of it, and it plays easily, I'll go, ooh, maybe I'll buy this, you know?
Yeah.
There's a couple of licks and like A licks, like Stevie Ray Vaughan type things that'll go into funky stuff that are, but it depends. If it's acoustic, I'll do like, maybe I'll do Over the Hills and Far Away by Zeppelin, or I'll tune it weird, or it just depends on the situation, but there's a couple of go-to things.
And you're the type of guy that can actually get away with tuning a guitar that you don't own to a weird
tuning. I mean, I don't drastically tune it. I'll drop the D or something like that. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't.
I remember I got yelled at Emerald City Guitars once for trying to detune something.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that. Those guys are good, though. Emerald City are actually really good dudes.
I freaking love that store.
I love Jay. I've favorites. Known Jay since he was, I mean, back in the... He used to work at guitars, et cetera. And I bought my second guitar, or my first, third guitar. I bought a lot of stuff from him back. He was the guy that would always give us good deals when we were kids.
Yeah.
Jay Boone was. Like, there were certain stores around here, who shall be nameless, that would not give you good deals.
Uh-huh.
Certain ones that are kind of... maybe in this vicinity, kind of by Green Lake. But I hate to say
it. Known. I know exactly which one you're talking about.
But Jay was not that way. He was always cool with us. You know, he's like, he's the first guy to give you two packs of strings. It was a big deal.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. So, that's a great place.
I've always loved him for that. And I love Emerald City. So.
Yeah. I'm a big guy. I'm a big fan of the vintage Fender instruments, too.
Yeah.
And they've always got, you know, a nice bevy of
they do.
Of guitars down there.
Yeah.
Yeah. When was the first time you bought the 1954 Stratocaster?
The 59 Strat?
Oh, 59.
Yeah, the 59. I bought that about 17 years ago. About 17 years ago in Los Angeles, California, Guitar Center down there. It was on the wall. It was my first kind of like, ooh, I can afford something
big. Purchase.
I can afford this. And,
yeah, man.
And I'm going to buy a nice guitar. And Stevie had a 59, so I'm going to buy a 59.
Right,
so
right.
That's why. And now it's, I love it dearly, and I use it. And it's still, it's super beat up, but I still love it.
No, that's what makes it. That's what makes it cool, right?
I love all the old beat up guitars. I do.
Oh, yeah.
Although tonight I don't have one of my beat ups, but
got one of the nice flashy ones.
Yeah.
For tonight's show.
My newest one I got was this '66 SG white SG, like Glenn Buxton from Alice Cooper Band used to have.
Yeah. Well, that's cool.
Yeah. I'm going to have to sit in and jam with these guys for a video thing. So, speaking of videos, I'm doing a video game when I shunned them for years. But I'm doing it to help my friend Danny. But keep going.
Yeah. So you know, I find it very admirable. We're fast-forwarding here in your life. But I find it very admirable that you take the time to do shows like this. You're still keeping grounded in the music scene in Seattle. You know, associating yourselves with acts like Star Anna and, you know, smaller bands and stuff like that. Do you have,
thanks.
Is playing a smaller venue something that you still hold in high regard?
I hold in high regard music, you know,
in all
genres and forms and young songwriters that are like Star Anna, who should be really big in my mind.
And
I love her voice.
I would agree with you.
And I will always want to help her because of that. And these guys are all my buds, you know. We grew up together, and I love them all, and I want to help them out. But I also want to jam with them, because it's fun to jam with them. It keeps me on my toes to play with these guys, you know. Because Tim DiGiulio is a great guitar player. Fucking Danny Newcomb's an awesome guitar player. So getting to play with those guys that I grew up with, and they keep me, I don't know if it's grounded, but they keep me kind of like, okay, I got to keep keep doing it. I got to keep playing as well as I can. And I support local music, and I support local clubs and local businesses, because... for so many years here in Seattle, prior to everything exploding, it was really small here, and there wasn't a lot of places to play. And you had to.
Right.
I was just driving by the Norway Center, which is now gone, where we shadow played one time, and that's where you had to put shows on when you were underage. You had to go to these different places to play shows, right? And I don't think that's the case anymore. I think there's more. I mean, I'm seriously not that in the loop of what's going on in music around anymore. I'm a dad. I have three kids. But, but you know, these are my friends, and then the Pink Slips are playing. This is kind of what I'm aware of. So
if I
can do something and be part of it, you know, and I like the Tractor. You know, I like Ballard.
It's it's a great, club, man. Yeah, I love this place. I love this place.
Everyone's grandparents lived here, right? That was the thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If you were a grandparent in Seattle in the '70s, you had to live here.
That's right.
By law.
Right. In Ballard.
Yeah.
So part of this, what I deem as being connected to the music scene here in Seattle and doing, smaller projects along with still keeping up with Pearl Jam and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Your latest venture is this new record label that you're starting, Hockey Doctor Records.
Hockey Doctor Records, yeah. It's what it basically is. It's just kind of, I love vinyl and I love record stores. Mm-hmm. I love every record store that's in Seattle and, you know, Easy Street to... what's the one in Fremont? I'm blanking right now, but
Silver Platters.
I like Silver Platters.
Everyday music.
Everyday is awesome.
Sonic
on
Boom.
Broadway. Sonic Boom is awesome. No, it's the other one. There's the vinyl one in you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
Fremont.
I do. Yeah, I can't remember.
I had the sticker in my house. This is gonna sound great in a podcast. I love all these record stores. I have no idea what their names are. But anyways, I like vinyl.
Just go
I love
there.
I collect vinyl. I've always had when I was on the road, yeah. You know, and I have a big vinyl collection. So I want to put that out. I'm going to put out 45s for – hey, Grace. I'm going to put out 45s for bands, you know, like a run of 100 or something or 500. And then
sure.
That's about it,
yeah.
You know. And then I'm not sure what it's going to take from there. I'm sure it's not going to make any money or anything. But this is our kind of coming out party. We don't have any stuff of these new bands, but we're going to put stuff out from them.
Yeah,
so
I think that's great, man.
Do they need me? Okay, thanks, George.
And vinyl is definitely coming back. And I mean, I like just kind of love the sound of vinyl.
It's warmer.
You know? Yeah.
And it's a tangible thing. There's artwork that goes along with it. And I'm,
right.
You know, and I don't know if kids these days whatever care about that and they want to listen to it, because I know that, you know, everybody's listening to their phones for stuff, and I just selfishly like vinyl because it's just fun to hold. And it's like that thing in Cameron Crowe's movie. It talks about how Penny Lane talks about you can go back in, you can see a bunch of your friends, or it's like visiting old friends
right.
being in a record store.
Right.
Hers was more literal maybe in the movie, but mine is like, I mean, I've been going to record stores since I was, whatever, 13, 14, cellophane was on the Ave. There's all many, tons of great ones that used to be there.
Totally.
But, you know, Easy Street's around. Sonic Boom, like you said, every day. They're all still here. So.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing with vinyl, too. It's like, I've had this conversation many, many times on the show. It's like, if you can sit down with it, you got to be engaged with it, right? Because you have to get up and actually switch the song if you want to, or flip it over, you know, stuff like that.
And you can look at all the liner notes and figure out who produced what. And
the artwork.
I was talking to Brandi Carlile about it, and she spent her formative years reading every single liner note of every single Elton John record.
Right.
And she knows everything. I mean, we went to Elton John together, and I was asking her questions. She knew who did the artwork to what produced what track, down to what the bass, everything.
Yeah.
So I like that kind of obsessive musicologist.
Yeah, yeah. That's great, man.
I hope to be that.
With everything that you've done, do you ever stop and just take a look back on what you've accomplished? Is there ever a wow moment for you?
I have many wow moments. I have, you know, if I can get by myself and meditate and hang out a little bit, like, I came over here early and I went to the Locks, and I love the Locks.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go there as a kid, my parents and my grandparents, long story, we'd always go through the Locks with their boats and stuff.
Sure.
And I have always loved the smell of the salt water and the mixture of the salt. So I can go there and I'll meditate for like 5 minutes and go, whew, it really happened.
Yeah.
How did I become a rock star? I mean, how did I become this thing that I wanted and wished for when I was 11 years old, when I go to bed at night and going, I'm not going to go to college. I'm not going to pay attention in school because I want to be a rock. You know, and I kind of did that, you know. And so how did it happen, you know? And so I feel very a huge sense of gratitude for that daily.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah, I do. I do have those moments. You know, it just depends. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic, man.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you sitting down with me and taking the time.
No worries.
It's been a complete honor.
Cool.
Thanks, Mike.
Hopefully, I answered some things and wasn't too chatty. No worries. Thanks.
Of course.
All right. And then I'd love to get a coffee.
Oh yeah. Well, there you have it, folks. Mike McCready of the band Pearl Jam joining us on Air Raid. That was awesome. That was awesome. I loved that. I absolutely loved that. What a great guy, too. Like I said, man, couldn't have much more admiration for a guy like that who continues to play music with his friends and plays in small clubs along with big giant arenas. If you haven't yet, you can check out PJ20, the movie, man, which is a fantastic documentary by Cameron Crowe on Pearl Jam. Also, go to their website at pearljam.com. You can check them out there and see what's coming up for the band there. Okay, let's see. Before we go, we'd like to remind you guys that if you want to come and see me do my thing up on stage, which is nothing compared to Mike McCready,
You can come and join us at Crackle Fest 5. That's right, Crackle Fest 5 happening here in Seattle at the Hard Rock Cafe on Friday, March 27th. It's going to be a lot of fun, man. It's $10. If you want to go to KirbyCrackleMusic.com, click on the show poster. You can buy tickets now. Going to have Burlesque Man and music by Cy Fried, Mega Ran, and, of course, Kirby Crackle. And it's a great time. We love it every year. I get up there and spew a couple of bad jokes and then do some giveaways. We do some trivia. We watch some burlesque. We watch some live music, and it's a lot of fun. Hard Rock Cafe, March 27th here in Seattle as part of the festivities surrounding Emerald City Comic Con. And, yeah, come and meet me. If you're a fan of the show, come and say hi. Yeah, we'll do that. It's $10 in advance and $13 at the door. So I hope to see you all there. Okay, like I said at the beginning of the show, we've got special things happening at the end of each episode now, right? Yeah, we do. And we'll get to that in a moment. But remember, you can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes. And if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. We are also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, and Cairo Radio apps. Or just visit www.air-raid.net to subscribe directly to our RSS feed. And also to access our archives with all 238 episodes for your streaming pleasure right there at the website. Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/ The Air Raid Podcast. Our Twitter handle is Air Raid Net, or email me directly at aaron@air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge, people. Pledge to tell someone about the show. Tell your friends, your mother, your sister, your brother. We will even take cousins. That's right. Okay, we're going to close out the show this week with the song Whipping off of Vitology from 1994. And here is your inspirational quote of the week as said by a 3.5-year-old.
Put your heart, mind, and soul to even into your smallest acts. This is the secret of success.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great week. We'll be right back.